whenever I've started a series, I always go into it with one idea, and then it turns out to be something completely different. And a huge part of that is the artist statement, which comes out of the images that you like versus the images that you don't like, and then it morphs. I mean,
This photography podcast is brought to you by Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. Here is your today's host, W. Scott Olsen, with another fascinating conversation.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another podcast from Frames Magazine. My name is Scott Olsen, and today, folks, oh, my heavens, today we are going to have so much fun. We are going to do a little bit of Hollywood. We're going to do a little bit of filmmaking. We're going to do a lot of photography and a really, really cool black and white, mostly film noirish approach to storytelling. In other words, we're talking with Daniel Sackheim. Dan is an award-winning film and television director and producer. His work has been in True Detective, that season, Game of Thrones, The Americans, my heavens, Servant, Better Call Saul, Jack Ryan, The Leftovers, Man in the High Castle, Ozark, Walking Dead, it just keeps going and going. He produced The X-Files, Fight the Future, had to get that one right, and his work as a movie producer, as a movie director, is instantly recognizable, and his photography is just absolutely mesmerizing in terms of its black and white and film noirish power. Dan, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Scott, I'm great. Thanks for having me. I clearly now have all this anxiety about how do I live up to that introduction, but thanks.
Yo, man, that's not exaggerating at all. Your credits are just out of this world in terms of producing a kind of aesthetic, producing a kind of look. And in doing my research, you're intentional about this. This is not accidental. But let's go backwards. You know, origin stories, I think, are always really interesting. You are the son of a screenwriter. Your brother's a photographer. You're a photographer and a film producer and director. So clearly, visual life has been important to you since very early on. When did you first come to know that, you know, film and still pictures was going to be, you know, your expression? And when did the camera first come into your hand?
Sure. Well, you know, I'd like to tell you that when I was about 8 years old, I had this vision of what I wanted to do with my life, but that would not be true. I really didn't have any idea what I was going to do. Yeah, my father was a pretty talented writer and television producer. My brother is an extraordinarily talented photographer. I actually kind of fell into this all by happenstance. You know, when I was a kid, I had a pretty severe learning disabilities. I still suffer from dyslexia to this day.
Okay.
And so I didn't really have a path figured out in life. And I went off to, but I like to take things apart and put them back together when I was a kid. And I think it was all about really process. I like to know how things work. I like to know, you know, and that sort of runs the gamut. And so I went to college figuring I would go to engineering school, right? Because engineers, they build things, they have to know how they work. The thing about it is that, you know, engineering, there's more math to an engineering major than there is to a math major. And you might not believe this, but math is actually my worst subject. I can barely balance a checkbook. So that actually didn't turn out too well. I spent about a year in school and then I dropped out. And I really didn't know what to do with myself, but I'd always sort of had this interest in acting. So I was able to audit these drama classes at UCLA, School of Drama. And my father, who had been incredibly generous to me in my life and had supported me through college, said, "Well, looks like you better get a job." So not knowing what to do with 1 year of college, unsuccessfully, I ended up getting a job at this place called the Videotape Company in Burbank, California. as Johnny Carson used to say, beautiful downtown Burbank, California. And it was not a particularly glamorous job. It was duplicating commercials and infomercials and so on and so forth. But they also produced them and they edited them. And I ended up befriending a group of these editors. Nothing like you would imagine today where you can, you know, you can edit a feature film on your home computer. These were like these big, huge machines that weighed about 5 tons and were complicated to keep working. So, but I, you know, I kind of fell in love with the idea of storytelling. And so I approached my father for the first time ever to ask for his advice and said, do you know anyone who could, you know, where I could maybe learn more about editing? And he introduced me to this woman. Her name was Margaret Booth. She was 84 years old at the time, and she had been this legendary film editor and had gone on to become an executive back in the 30s and 40s at MGM during sort of the heyday of all of their big movies. And she was Irving Thalberg's right-hand gal. For those who don't know, Irving Thalberg ran MGM Studios during its most golden years. He was this kind of a macher or a mogul, a movie mogul. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I started out doing the kind of things that are generally pretty exciting for someone looking to go into the arts. I took her car out to get it washed. I picked up groceries. I picked up a dry cleaning, those kind of things. And then
classic intern, I love it.
Yeah, little by little, I started at the bottom. Literally about as the bottom as the bottom can get. And little by little, though, I was an apprentice film editor, which is a title that doesn't even really exist anymore. But little by little, I learned the craft of editing, became an assistant editor. And then over the years, the editors that she worked with would, you know, after I finished my day's work as an assistant, they would give me rolls of film that I would cut. And they would come in the next morning, look at the work, tell me it was crap, and start again from scratch. And that's how it all sort of started. Years later, after I had been doing this for a while, and I was looking to become a full-fledged editor, but this was the movie business. And back then, it was very sort of stodgy, and they were not about to give a 26-year-old kid a movie to edit. So I went into television, where all of a sudden the producers that I worked for, they were like, you know, a couple years older than I was. It was just a kind of a paradigm shift. And it, you know, streaming, those kind of things hadn't evolved yet. But anyway, right. it was an environment which I had the opportunity to learn a lot. And I worked on a lot of projects and I was able to move up. One of the projects that I worked on was a reboot of this show, Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And I cut one of the episodes of this trilogy, and the show unexpectedly got picked up as a regular series. And one day the producer, one of the producers came up to me and said, hey, you know, we're looking for an associate producer for the series. Is that something you'd be interested in doing? And I said, absolutely. And they said, well, do you know what an associate producer does? I go, of course I do. And so he said, okay. And that process started. I had not a clue what an associate producer does.
So I was waiting for that.
Yeah, and I said, tell me what the job is. So it turns out it was mostly sort of supervising editorial, sometimes working as a music supervisor, picking music, et cetera, et cetera.
There's a number of things in there I want to go back to it and touch on. And when you say, you know, selecting music and stuff, you did that for Miami Vice, you know, one of the most famous soundtrack TV shows, you know, that was ever around. But let's go back a bit. You have said before that your film school was being an apprentice editor, film editor. That was your version of going to film school. And you said, you know, people came in and they would give you, you know, advice on your work. But tell me more. Tell me what kind of aesthetic were they teaching you back then? How do you learn I mean, I've got a little block on my desk that we used to use for editing audio tape. You know, you'd put the little thing in there, get the tape, you'd razor blade, and you'd splice it.
God, I know. Remember that? Crazy. It's like living in the Pleistocene era.
Absolutely. Listen, I remember 2-inch and 1-inch videotape. You know, that was where I got started. So
right, yeah, same 2-inch videotape.
Way wow. Back in those, but you know, being able to splice has nothing to do with the aesthetic of what to splice. Sure. So tell me what they were teaching you in terms of vision and how storytelling gets made.
Sure. Well, the thing is, you know, if you consider that the way that you shoot a movie is the building block of how you tell the story, right? The building blocks of how you tell a story. And, and you know, and actually, I think most people would agree that you don't tend to learn from your successes. You learn from your failures, right? You learn what not to do.
Right.
Well, in working as an editor, you see, and an assistant editor, you see directors making all kinds of mistakes all the time, either in terms of how the scene is staged or how what the intention or lack of intention is, what the point of view is or lack of point of view. And you would see those. And as an editor, you had to try to find creative ways to sort of work around them. And so one of the reasons that I think editing is such a fundamentally important craft or skill to learn is you're, in essence, you're telling the story, but you're telling the story with sort of physical components. And also choosing point of view, performance. Why does a performance work this way? How do you build the performance editorially, which then translates to if, say, you want to direct? Those are skills that presumably that you've, you know, sort of sunk into your, you know, into my thick skull. And, you know, everyone operated in a different way. You would see the different styles of directors. And then I would go down, hang out on set. It also encouraged me as I started to realize that filmic or visual storytelling was something that I was interested in, that I would start watching the work of renowned directors. And I actually worked on one of the last films that John Huston directed. And, you know, I got to sort of sit next to him sometimes and ask him questions about the movies he had done. I mean, part of it, I think, is by osmosis. And part of it is paying attention and a desire to learn. And I think that's always been the thing that's propelled me in anything that I've done to any levels of whatever success I have or have not accomplished is a really burning desire to learn and master something. I'm not saying that I've mastered anything, but a desire to master something, right?
That is the key right there. Let's pause for another moment just on this notion of storytelling. In another context, you told a great story about where film noir came along. You know, its birth coming out of the war, you know, lack of lights and studios, money, this, you know, and people coming back from the war really in dark moods for a variety of reasons. But in listening to you explain that, you really didn't go after the visual aesthetic. You went after the psychological impact. So when you say you're a storyteller, you know, thinking about how often you mention you want your viewers, your audience to have a kind of reaction, what does story mean to you?
Wow, that's a great question. It is something primal, right? Because it goes back to the days of the caveman and putting pictographs or cave drawings up on the cave wall, and there's a tradition of storytelling of people sitting around a fire cooking food at night, and a way of telling stories to perhaps entertain, but I think also to share life's experiences as a way of understanding each other better through stories, as a way of creating fables or morality tales, and of conveying these morality tales to our youth. right? By telling them in stories. And I guess it really evolves that way in terms of what makes a story compelling. God, I don't completely know how to articulate it. I sort of know it when I see it as a photographer.
Yep.
And I know it when I feel it as a director. But a lot of it, one thing that I talk about a lot to young directors who are coming up, or directors that I might hire to direct a TV series that I produce, is point of view. Point of view is really important in storytelling. I think it's important when you tell a joke, and I think it's important when you tell a story or you relate a story visually, because you typically want to be with the hero. And you want to be in seeing the story through the hero's eyes, or hearing it through their voice and seeing it through their eyes. So story is a form of recantation of a life experience and a journey that has no predictable, or is best when it has no predictable outcome, or rather, that you endeavor to subvert the expectations of the audience by taking them through a journey that has no obvious predetermined resolution, I guess would be the right word. I think when we tend to get bored with stories, or we come up with the word that it's a trite or cliche or a trope, is because we know what the ending is going to be before we get there, right? For me, the key to storytelling, or what I love about storytelling, is being taken for a ride where I don't know where I'm going to end up.
And the ride is not content. But when I say content, I mean it's not plot. It's emotion. It's character. Everybody that went to see the Titanic movie knew that the boat sank at the end. They knew that walking in. But that's not what the story was, right?
No, it's an epic love story that happens to the tragedy of it. Why it is a tragedy, a Greek tragedy, is it's an unfulfilled love story, or in a sense, an unrequited love story, by virtue of the fact that they're doomed. And it becomes about, but it becomes about sacrifice, and it becomes about love, as a total aside, right? I think there are two. Talking about that movie, there are two really key moments in that movie that are the most important moments in that movie, in that love story. It's a classic love story. Do you know what those two moments are?
Not a clue.
So those two moments for me would be the first time that Leo DiCaprio's character is painting a nude portrait of Kate Winslet's character. And that's because an expression of love, it comes through trust. You can't truly love someone. You can lust after them. You can want them. Mm-hmm. You can desire them. You can be inured with them. But true love has to come through trust. And so there's that ultimate moment of trust where they're connecting because he's painting her. And the second moment is, it's like that penultimate moment at the end of the movie where
she climbs the rail.
Well, they're bobbing up and down in the water, and they can't be on that raft. Only one can.
Yeah.
And he makes the sacrifice he sacrifices his life for her. It's the ultimate sacrifice. And again, that's about trust. So trust equals love.
And we're gonna get to the photography specifically here in just a second. But
I've gone way over at a deep end here. I'm so sorry. I don't know where you wanted to go.
This is fascinating. I'm loving this. But now, okay, you're wearing your producer's hat at the moment, and you've just been telling me the stuff that I hear from photographers a lot. I say, what are you taking a picture of? And they'll tell me an emotion. I'm working on a project about anger. I'm working on a project about love or trust or whatever. But if you're a producer and you're hiring a director and you're hiring a cinematographer and how do you look at them and say, I'm making a movie about trust? Or is that really not the conversation that ever gets had?
Well, I've never hired a director on a movie, but on a TV series, you want to make sure that they understand what the aesthetic of the show is, what the right. meter rhythm of the shows are, what the visual signature of the shows is. And again, you know, I always come back to point of view. Whose point of view do you want to be in for, you know, any given scene? Because a scene can be destroyed if it has either there is no concrete point of view or it's the wrong point of view. I mean, anyone can shoot a, you know, in television, in movies, there are certain formulas that we've, visual paradigms, editorial paradigms that we've lived with since the beginning of cinema, right? There's, and those are big wide shots that what they call masters, where you establish all your characters and you establish their geography and the relationship to each other. And then over shoulders or two shots where you connect people together, and then individual mm-hmm. close-ups. And then you use those close-ups to try to relate someone's perspective, right? You can mm-hmm. shoot all of that and it doesn't necessarily convey a point of view, or you can shoot a scene like, the famous one that I think I'm from a TV series, True Detective season one, shot by the very talented director, Cary Fukunaga. And there's a scene where Matthew McConaughey he's trying to smuggle someone out of this kind of drug infested neighborhood. And it plays as a one-er. For anyone who doesn't know what that is, it's a single contained shot that does not stop. It does not cut for other angles or coverage. You are just in that shot for whatever period of time. There are many famous ones like, you know, the opening of the Orson Welles film Touch of Evil, et cetera, et cetera. In any case, so Matthew McConaughey is smuggling this guy out, and you are with him in this pretty much incredible one-er out and about. And so you're only seeing it from their sort of selective point of view. And it has a great impact. Also, I think the fact that, for those who don't know this, every time you cut from one angle to another, there's perhaps imperceptible amount of time, but there is a period of time where you're between those two shots. And it's a time where the audience loses their focus on the scene. It's an infinitesimal amount of time, but it adds up.
Right.
And when okay. you're looking at a one-er, though you may not be aware that you're looking at the one-er, you can't look away. It's just much harder. Next time you see a scene like that, think about it or go back and look at it again. Mm-hmm. You really can't look away. It's this kind of magical thing about it. But it also allows you to be with that character, telling the story through that character's proverbial eyes, through their proverbial point of view. And it is one reason that it is so effective. It has all these kind of cinematic gymnastics about it, for sure. But that's not the reason that it's so compelling. It's compelling because you're locked into someone's point of view.
Let's take just a quick break. We hope very much that you are enjoying today's episode. The very fact that you are listening to this podcast suggests that photography means a lot to you. And if that's the case, you might want to have a look at Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. We truly believe that excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit readframes.com to find out more about our publication. And now, back to today's conversation.
Okay, you've just given me a great segue into your photography and into a bunch of other things that I want to talk about. Because in the film and TV world, you've got time. For the narrative arc, you know, can be 30 minutes, it can be 3 hours. But you have multiple scenes, all sorts of time in the world. And yet you have, and clearly the carryover from film and TV into still photography in terms of, you know, composing within a frame, in terms of lighting and all that, I mean, you can see immediate benefits or transitions from one to the other. But you have said that the strength of a photograph, of a still image, comes from its fixity. That was the word you used. The fact that it is absolutely an isolated fraction of a second, and its ambiguity. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, where does strength come from in fixity and ambiguity?
Right. So it obviously depends on what the imagery is, right?
Right. Yeah.
So you're familiar with the photographer Joel Meyerowitz, yes?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So Joel Meyerowitz has this very famous photo. I believe it was shot in New York. I don't know where, but it's a street scene. And on the street scene, we see that a man is laying on the ground, and there's some people moving past him, and there's some people moving towards him. And then there's a man holding something in the air in one of his hands. I can't remember what it was, whether it was a hammer or some kind of a tool. That's all you know. You don't know what happened. You don't know if he was hit, if he fell, if he's been laying there for 10 minutes, if he has a heart attack. You don't know if the man who's holding the tool is moving towards him to hit him. The ambiguity of that is in and of itself compelling. So if that was a scene that was shot on film, you would have the obligation to show what comes before and what comes after. And then so the mystery lies in how you make that, how you subvert expectations, or how you find a way to convey threat. You know, maybe you're over the shoulder of the guy with the hammer and you're moving towards him and you want to scream out as an audience member, "Oh my God, turn around. Or, you know, you're on the guy's face and he's, you know, lost and he's trying to figure out where he is. He's late for a business meeting and he's looking at his watch. And now you see off behind him, off in the distance, someone who's out of focus, but coming closer and falling into focus, and now they're holding something in their hands. I'm like, oh my God, is he going to hit that guy? I mean, there's a number of ways to tell the story, right? But that's the cinematic approach. Why I love that image so much, and why it becomes sort of a still paradigm for me, has to do with the fact that there's a ton of unanswered questions, and you can sit and stare at that photo for 15 minutes trying to figure it out, never come up with the answer, but you also generate your own version of a story in your head. Mm-hmm. That to me is the value of the fixity of an image, obviously with the proviso that the scene or sequence or whatever it is you're looking at is a compelling, as a compelling proposition for a story.
So in the photographs that you respond to, your own work and the work of people you admire, there is almost by definition or by requirement a pre-image and post-image component to what you're looking at.
That's right.
Okay.
I did work on a project actually with another photographer years ago, and it was an adaptation of a noir screenplay called Slow Kiss. And we never completely finished it because we ran out of money. But we shot it with actors over the course of about 2.5 years. And we endeavored to tell the story, this cinematic story, in either one frame for a scene or maybe a combination of maybe three images. But that was always the idea, was how do you tell a conventional or a cinematic narrative in still frames and do it in a way that it actually works for this medium as opposed to against it, and it tells the story in a very different way than you would tell the story if you were shooting a conventional motion picture.
Mm-hmm. We should tell everyone this series is on your website, and it's beautiful. I was going to get there in just a second. I mean, absolutely fantastic images. But what's the difference between that and someone just say, "Oh, I'm doing a series on downtown streetlights"?
I guess it depends if you find streetlights interesting.
are you doing something different than just a series?
Yeah, you know, so. Here's this is a bigger conversation. It gets into process about style and why you choose a subject and how you put a series together, which has been an evolution for me in understanding, because whenever I've started a series, I always go into it with one idea, and then it turns out to be something completely different. And a huge part of that is the artist statement, which comes out of the images that you like versus the images that you don't like, and then it morphs. I mean, it's a transitory kind of thing, you know. I mean, streetlights can be, you know, I have images where there's no one in them, but there is an element to them that is meant to convey something about liminal space and about the idea of not feeling sure-footed or not feeling grounded or those kind of things. I mean, I like to think that I may not think of it consciously at the time, but I'm going for something that creates some kind of, it taps into some kind of feeling of mine. If it comes across to the audience, I truly can't say, but that's the intention.
This is genius, because you said in a different context again that the difference between your work and, you know, traditional street photography or photojournalism is that you are bringing a bias.
Yeah, for sure.
What do you mean? What do you mean? And that, you know, if I'm doing a series on streetlights, I apologize to everybody out there who loves streetlights. You're doing a documentary project. That's very different than saying I'm bringing a bias to this project I've got here. So for you, what do you mean by you're bringing a bias?
Well, let me talk in a broader context first, because that's a really smart comment on your part. There, what I consider me personally. What I personally consider to be the difference between street photography and documentary photography is that a documentary is supposed to be as objective as humanly possible. That you're not supposed to, I mean, we all do insert our bias, but I mean, ideally, you want it to be shot in a fairly objective way to allow the to not bring your bias to it or not impose on the film or photograph your own point of view. Okay. And I think there are amazing documentarians. Again, this is just my take on it. I'm sure documentarians would have a different point of view. Street or I like to think of what I do in some ways kind of is narrative street or fine art street. I don't know what the term of it would actually be. But I do approach it with a very specific intention to tie it to either an emotion or to an action, something that that evokes something in me that I hope will be evoked in a viewer, an audience, right? Because I don't think anyone should set out with the idea of, oh, I want to elicit this reaction. I want to elicit that reaction from me. And if somebody else gets it, great. But I don't think you do your work for someone else, whether it's a movie or a obviously, we would have a lot of very unsuccessful movies if the director or creator didn't have something in common with the masses. But you know what I mean, right?
Yeah, every accountant in the film world is now screaming, but okay.
Yeah.
Man, okay. I'm looking at your series here called Unseen, and at the Susan Spiritus Gallery, you know, let out one of your deep, dark secrets here. She says that you told her that, you know, when you were scared of the dark when you were a little kid. Is that where the love of noir comes from, of night shots?
Well, it's a bit more complicated than that, but. I was actually commenting on the fact that there's an irony. The irony is that I was terrified of the dark as a kid, and I would need my parents to check under my bed or in the closet, you know, the kid stuff.
Yeah.
That I would sometimes sleep with the lights on, and I had bad nightmares. And I think it started out as I wanted to try to do something about that. And I had no idea how to do it. I wanted to do something about a character, you know, in a movie that I was writing, and I never finished it. And I always wanted to try to bring it to something photographically, and I could never quite figure out how to do it. But coincident with that, when I started to learn about film, when I started to study the work of famous directors and producers, I kind of fell in love with noir, I think, because it so subverts the expectations of what we imagine the male-female dynamic or love affair to be. And I was also just fascinated visually with the style of it, the long shadows. And,
oh, me too, man. Me too.
You know, whether it's A Touch of Evil or Sweet Smell of Success, couldn't be more different kinds of films, but there is a patina to them, this kind of richness, the dark blacks. I just sort of fell in love with it. And I also really fell in love with black and white photography. I shoot color. I just don't think I'm as good at it as black and white. And I think, you know, you get kind of a leg up. You get help from black and white to begin with, right? Because we see in color. Right. So by virtue of the fact that it's in black and white, it already starts to have a quality to it that is heightened from what we experience every day. Especially for people unlike myself who grew up with black and white television, right? there's something special about it. And then I think I fell in love with this idea of creating a frame that was black and finding an image inside of it to tell, so that on the periphery, there was always this sense of what's lurking out there. That was the intention anyway. Whether it comes across, I don't know. But that's, I think, why I kind of fell into this style.
Well, it is, from my point of view, a tremendous success. And I have to admit, you know, I'm part of the choir already. I love black and white. I love film noir. I love night shots. These have spoken to me for a long time, but you've clearly mastered this. And you're saying some stuff that is both original and deep. Tell me the story of the first, and this again, on your website, when you're looking at the series, the sort of montage or the shot that begins with the freeway on top, then the subway in the middle, and then the Los Angeles theater just below that. Tell me the story of this image.
Is it the Los Angeles theater shot, or is it the image of the tram?
It looks like, there's a cut there.
I'm sorry. I think you're looking at something on my website where the two images melded together totally by accident because I'm a Luddite and I don't know how to properly program my website. It has nothing to do with some genius concept on my part. I'm just an imbecile when it comes to knowing how to.
No. This looks like one of those 1940s sort of superimposition fade things that used to be.
Yeah, wouldn't that be cool? That's a plot for a movie, probably. Some idiot who can't figure out how to put his website together, and it inspires all kinds of ideas on people. It's like being there.
Okay. Do tell me the image of the Los Angeles, or tell me the story of the Los Angeles theater shot then.
Right. So I live in Los Angeles. I was looking for a project for those who don't know, downtown Los Angeles was actually Broadway Street in Los Angeles, not New York, was the home of the original movie Palace. And before Hollywood became Hollywood, before Hollywood and Vine, where all the movie palaces opened up with all the premieres that everybody has seen in films, with the Klieg lights going back and forth, that actually was in downtown Los Angeles. And downtown Los Angeles is sort of unlike any other downtown that I've been to elsewhere. Most downtowns, as we know, they are centers for not only commerce and business, but shopping and department stores, fashion, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Downtown Los Angeles actually fell on some really hard times back in the 60s. And all those movie theaters, they shuttered. Many of them sort of were taken over to become like these spaces for bazaars or churches or what have you. And in the past few years, there's been this kind of revitalization downtown where they're endeavoring to rehab these beautiful movie palaces with, you know, 3,000 seats and chandeliers and the kind of things you just, you know, just went away when they started to build these multiplexes. And I started to do this series on them. And I got about halfway through it and COVID hit. And what had been left for me to do was to actually go inside the movie theaters and shoot the interiors of them. And when COVID hit, that all got scotched, and I never finished the series. But one of the photos that I took was from high above, looking down the street onto the Los Angeles movie theater. It's the oldest movie theater, certainly in Los Angeles, maybe one of the oldest in America, for all I know, and one of the largest. And it, I shot this theater, and someone was walking by underneath through these kind of pools of light that had been created by the street lamps. Mm-hmm. And it just felt very noirish. The title of it is LA Noir. And that was one of the things that sort of got me thinking about trying to do a noir-inspired series, which is a little bit of it's a little tricky, a little bit of a – you can paint yourself into a little bit of a corner, because I think a lot of people construe noir as – well, it's a black and white image, and it's got a lot of blacks, and it's got whites in it, and that's noir, yeah. And it's not. And I won't tell you that every image in this series is a classic noir series. It's not. It doesn't have a guy in a brimmed hat, you know, covering his eyes, smoking a cigarette with smoke wafting up through. It's more the sense of what it evokes in you and my love of that genre. And I continue to work on that to today, more so not street, but working with actors or models. I really haven't posted any of that recently.
Okay. And I should tell everyone, you know, one more click into your website and I see the image the way it's intended and the tram one next to it. But to stay with it, with the theater shot, just for one more quick sort of technical question, mm-hmm. you're not on the street. You're, you know, what, 4 or 5 stories up in the air, I assume, on a building, you know, across the street or whatever.
I shot it with a drone, actually.
Oh, really? Okay. So then, but you envisioned the point of view as being the top-down shot. I mean,
it was also a little bit of a love letter to Los Angeles, right? And the Los Angeles theater. So I wanted to shoot past the marquee, this big, beautiful neon sign that says Los Angeles. And I tried sneaking up into rooftops across the way from it. I tried all kinds of things. You know, I hired somebody to show up with a ladder, and I eventually realized the only way that I could get the shot I wanted to get was with a drone.
Somebody needs to do an anthology of photographers sneaking into places just to get an angle that they've got in their head.
Oh my God. Absolutely. That would be a great series. You're absolutely right. I have gotten kicked out of some really, really good places.
Oh man, we've all been chased away from a great shot at some point in our life. And trespassing is probably our second best skill. Tell me the shot, the information booth. Is that the train station?
It is. So as it happened, for those who haven't been to the Union Station, it is this beautiful vintage built in the early 20s, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Train station downtown Los Angeles, and there's an information booth. as it happened on this, I go there pretty often. And as it happened on this one day, behind the information booth is this other really beautiful room where all it was where the tickets were sold originally back in the 20s. And they've left them, kept it in its very vintage state.
The movie set, yes.
It's like a movie set. It's it's really gorgeous. And they were doing, they do events there. And I guess they were either rehabbing it or doing some events, or there was a film company. I couldn't tell you what it was. And they had hung these big black drapes in front of it to cut it, you know, cut it off from view from the incoming and outgoing public. And it created this whole another world of this information booth kind of just floating in black.
Yeah.
And I just happened to catch this woman who was working there who looked like she was daydreaming. And so it just was this happenstance of fortune on that day. I can truly say I don't think anyone has a picture of that booth looking like that.
No, I was going to ask you about all sorts of sort of invasive post-production here because I have stood at that booth. As a matter of fact, one afternoon, you know, they've generally got a velvet rope up, you know, so you can't get into that section of the station. And I asked one of the guards, I said, how often does somebody just sort of jump the rope, run in, get a picture and run back out? And he gave me a really stern look and he said, seldom. And I just looked at him. I said, good. And I stood there and we stood there for about 20 minutes, just watching each other. he was ready for me to go dashing in there, but it was one of those days where it was a little bit of dust in the air, those huge windows. You've got those great beams of light.
Get those huge beams of light coming in, dust motes. No, it wasn't. I mean, look, there is a little bit of post-production in terms of crushing the blacks a bit more than they are, but no, but it's really there. It's a physical thing behind it that ended up creating this slightly surreal moment. And I think that's the other thing too. I'm always looking for a kind of elevated visual aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the series In Color now that you call Vacancy. What's the idea behind this one?
Yeah, so it's very much a work in progress. Again, it's one of those things where it starts out being something else. So it started out wanting to be about, there's an image in there where you see a vintage motel, and there I shot it with at a slow shutter speed where you sort of see the streaks of car lights heading past it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the idea was that I wanted to do something about time and how we all measure time in different ways, right? So if you're 4 years old, a year in your life is 1/4 of your life. So a year, remember being a kid and summer's going on forever? And now you, as an adult, you blink. Well, what happened this summer? Oh, that was yesterday. You didn't catch it? And so I was experimenting with ideas about trying to manipulate time as a means of showing how – or trying to convey how we express time. And I think it was a complete and total failure as an exercise. I could never really figure out how to do it. But somewhere along the process of doing it, it was usually somewhat specific in terms of architecture as a way of speaking to time signatures. I was looking to do it around buildings that were of an era. So there came with it a kind of a quality of nostalgia that radiated from the image that you wouldn't have to expect, you wouldn't have to try to formulate or create. And with a somewhat modern affect, and I'll truly call it a visual affect on top of it. But mm-hmm. what I came to realize that I really wanted it to end up being about, and I haven't updated that in a while, was this sense that, you know how when you're... human beings are the only creatures that think in the future. We always think about right. tomorrow. And when I get that raise, I'm going to be happy. When I find the love of my life, I'm going to be content, right? And I sort of think of everything that we pass through on our way there as this kind of liminal space in which we're not really rooted, or, you know, you're painting your house, and so you moved into a temporary apartment space. And I sort of became fascinated with this idea of that I have never really felt settled. I have a beautiful home that I live in with my wife, and I've been here for 10 years. And this is probably the closest thing that I have to something that feels permanent to me. But nothing else ever has felt permanent. And part of that may be that I've lived a life of kind of this filmic hunter-gatherer. You know, in television, you have a job for 3 months, then you have a job for 3 months, then you have a job for 6 weeks, and then you have a job for 12 weeks or what have you. And I've spent most of my adult and professional life that way, never really feeling grounded, never feeling like I was landing somewhere. And so and to me, that's about a space that feels empty, unpopulated, lacking a number of people or lacking furniture or what have you. And so I wanted to try to, and I think I'm still endeavoring to do so, is tell a story with images that conveyed, at least for me, the intent being to convey this kind of a transitory nature. And that the streaks that are from cars or things like that that are going through speak to the transitory nature of the life that we live, right? Because we're only put on this earth for a short period of time and then we're gone. And so even a building that has been there for 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years, it's aging, and people don't stop. They don't stop to look at it. It ages. So it was my own, God, what sounds overly pretentious, but that the idea behind vacancy became this notion of the transitory nature of life.
And you know what? At least from my point of view, that is absolutely filled with promise and grace, because if you're a curious person, you're never quite settled, but there's always the promise of the next thing. You know, someone walks into a library and you say, you know, have you read all these books? The answer should be, I hope not. Yeah. You know, there's something in your work. I'm looking at that picture of the hotel, the vacancy sign, the light streaks right now. And it is complex in terms of the layers of narrative in there. It's complex in terms of this tonal quality, sort of this technical. But man, that vacancy sign right there in the middle just makes me want to leap into the picture, the story of the picture, and say, oh, there's something going on here. One last question, because we're going to run out of time. It's a really mundane question, but I got to ask. I'm looking at your website here again. You've got a whole group now that you're offering as NFTs. Is that the future?
I don't know. I don't understand them. I'm just being honest. You know, I've made one NFT. It's been sitting on this platform, Super Rare. And yep. I did it because I was advised that that was the future. And at the end of the day, I guess I'm a lemming. I don't really know how to describe it. I have a lot of art in my home because I love yes. looking at paintings and photographs, a lot of vintage photographs from great photographers. And I love to sit down and put on a piece of music and pour myself a glass of wine and stare at them. That has always been the experience for me. So I will tell right. you, and it is probably largely because of my age, that I've never fully understood the NFT market, and which is why you don't see any more on there. And I've largely sort of abandoned it for the moment. Maybe they will come to serve some purpose or some utility that I don't understand, but I don't understand it fully. So I have to.
You and me both, brother. You and me both. And there are, I know a number of people who are really excited about this. And so I saw that there. And my first reaction was, I am too old to understand this. But It's a beautiful image. I mean, I really I think it's great.
I think I can give you a shorthand of what I think it is about. So I'm of an age where I invite people into my home to have dinner and conversation, and they look at the art and they comment on the art. We talk about it. But there is a generation, you know, Gen Zers being key, that their lives are really about going out, right? And experiencing a restaurant or an event or a concert with people, and they're out. And they can pull out their phone and say, check out this image that I bought. And so you're sharing it, but you're sharing it in a very different way. That is my only attempt to give it a sense of legitimacy. And I don't know that I'm right. It's just supposition on my part.
Oh, Dan, I have enjoyed every word of this. This is an incredibly smart body of work, and I love listening to you explain what's going on there. Your history is profound. The work is thrilling. Thank you very much for being with us today.
It's been a sheer pleasure. Scott, thank you so much for having me. I'm a fan of the podcast and and of you. Thank you. It's really been fun.
Frames, because excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit us at www.readframes.com.